We conclude our series of interviews with former White House press secretaries with Scott McClellan. Last spring, he published a memoir that was critical of the Bush administration and what McClellan describes as Washington's culture of deception. McClellan describes himself as someone who had been a Texas loyalist, a trusted member of the president's senior-most team of advisors. He first worked for Bush in 1999 as his gubernatorial spokesman. He was a traveling press secretary for the Bush-Cheney 2000 campaign, and during President Bush's first term was chief deputy to Press Secretary Ari Fleischer. He served as President Bush's press secretary from July 2003 through May 2006. I spoke with McClellan in June when his memoir was published. Now, one of the things you write about in the book is how the White House would enlist the help of conservative talk show hosts and other, quote, friends in the media, conservative columnists, talk radio personalities, and they'd be given communications packets with comprehensive talking points. How does that work?
That's right. No, I mean, you pretty much just summed it up. We had a massive operation in the White House, massive political operation. It was not new. It certainly existed before us. I think to some extent we took it to new lengths. And Karl Rove, of course, being the senior advisor. But everything was well coordinated amongst some of the political operation in the Office of Strategic Initiatives, for example, as well as the White House communications operation. And when we need to get information out. We've got a whole long list of conservative allies and friends, whether it's talk radio, whether it's columnists in the newspapers. And it's all part of that effort to shape the media narrative to our advantage.
I'd like to play one or two of the more dramatic moments of your press conferences and talk about what was happening in your mind or behind the scenes at this time. And this was, I think, a particularly uncomfortable press briefing for you. You had been telling the press that Karl Rove and Scooter Libby assured you that they had nothing to do with leaking Valerie Plame Wilson's name and that she was a CIA operative. Then the story broke that Rove did talk about her with at least one reporter. The reporters at the press briefing were asking you about that, and you refused to comment, saying you couldn't comment on an ongoing investigation. And then the reporters were saying, well, why couldn't you comment on it now when you seemed free to comment on it earlier when what you were saying was, no, they didn't know anything.
Right.
So here's David Gregory questioning you July 11th, 2005.
Scott, can I ask you this? Did Karl Rove commit a crime?
Again, David, this is a question relating to an ongoing investigation, and you have my response related to the investigation. And I don't think you should read anything into it other than we're going to continue not to comment on it while it's ongoing.
Do you stand by your statement from the fall of 2003 when you were asked specifically about Carl and Elliot Abrams and Scooter Libby, and you said, I've gone to each of those gentlemen, and they have told me they are not involved in this. Do you stand by that statement?
And if you will recall, I said that as part of helping the investigators move forward on the investigation, we're not going to get into commenting on it. That was something I stated back near that time as well.
Scott, this is ridiculous. The notion that you're going to stand before us after having commented with that level of detail and tell people watching this that somehow you've decided not to talk, you've got a public record out there. Do you stand by your remarks from that podium or not?
And again, David, I'm well aware, like you, of what was previously said, and I will be glad to talk about it at the appropriate time. The appropriate time is when the investigation...
When it's appropriate, when it's inappropriate.
If you'll let me finish...
No, you're not finishing. You're not saying anything. You stood at that podium and said that Karl Rove was not involved, and now we find out that he spoke about that Joseph Wilson's wife. So don't you owe the American public a fuller explanation? Was he involved or was he not? Because contrary to what you told the American people, he did indeed talk about his wife, didn't he?
David, there will be a time to talk about this, but now is not the time to talk about it.
Do you think people will accept that, what you're saying today?
Again, I've responded to the question. Go ahead, Terry.
Okay, that was my guest Scott McClellan with David Gregory of NBC at a White House press briefing July 11th, 2005. Scott McClellan, so why couldn't you comment then?
Well, the short answer is that the White House counsel's office tied my hands, as they did anyone that was speaking publicly at the White House. They said, we're not going to talk about this. This is an ongoing legal proceeding and you can't talk about it. I actually, back at that, shortly after that time, or even around that time, I told White House reporters that someday I looked forward to talking about this. And I think they came to realize that I was very sincere in that. That was an extremely difficult period because I could not defend what I had previously said about 2 years earlier. I did tell reporters 2 years prior to that that Scooter Libby and Karl Rove had both assured me that they were not involved in the leaking of Valerie Plame's identity. It's interesting how that came about. Part of that was conversations with Karl Rove. Karl Rove had also told the president he was not involved, and the president and I had a discussion about that. And then about a week later after the investigation broke, the president and vice president spoke and directed me to exonerate Scooter Libby, as well as in addition to Carl, because his name was coming up in some of the conversation and some of the Washington rumor mill. And I said, the only way I will do that, told the chief of staff, Andy Carr, the only way I will do that is if Scooter Libby gives me the same assurances that Karl Rove did. And so I got Scooter on the phone. He was traveling with the vice president then, and said, asked him exactly what I asked Carl. Were you involved in this, the leaking of Valerie Plame's identity, in any way? And he said, no, absolutely not. Carl had given me the same assurances, unequivocal. No, we were not involved. And there's nothing more important for the press secretary than his credibility. And what the press secretary says has to be based on what he believes to be true. And it was back then. But then when it is found out that it's not true and you can't correct the record, that makes it extremely difficult to continue in that position. And over time, it would eventually be a chief reason why I left the White House. That really set in this period of disillusionment in me because I was, rightly as David did, battered for not being able to, or for going into this no comment mode. It's a terrible position to be in for, you know, no comment is just a terrible communication strategy. You've got to be able to explain things and set the record straight when needed, particularly if something you said previously later turns out not to be the case.
I want to play another White House press briefing clip. And this is from October 13th, 2005. And here it's Helen Thomas who is asking you the questions. And this is about the war in Iraq.
President Mita, what do you mean by total victory? That we will never leave Iraq until we have total victory. What does that mean?
Free and democratic Iraq in the heart of the Middle East, because a free and democratic Iraq in the heart of the Middle East will be a major blow to the ambitions.
If they ask us to leave, then we'll leave.
Okay, I'm trying to respond. Well, a free and democratic Iraq in the heart of the broader Middle East will be a major blow to the ambitions of Al-Qaeda and their terrorist associates. They want to establish or impose their rule over the broader Middle East. We saw that in the Zawahiri letter that was released earlier this week by the intelligence community. Well, Helen, the president recognizes that we are engaged in a global war on terrorism. And when you're engaged in a war, it's not always pleasant, and it's certainly a last resort. But when you engage in a war, you take the fight to the enemy. You go on the offense, and that's exactly what we're doing. We are fighting them there so that we don't have to fight them here. September 11th taught us.
Iraq had nothing to do with 9/11.
Yeah, well, you have a very different view of the war on terrorism, and I'm sure you're opposed to the broader war on terrorism. The president recognizes this requires a comprehensive strategy, and that this is a broad war, that it is not a law enforcement matter.
Terry, sorry, on what basis do you say Helen is opposed to the broader war on terrorism?
Well, she certainly expressed her concerns about Afghanistan and Iraq and going into those two countries. I think I can go back and pull up her comments over the course of the past couple of years.
And speak for her, which is odd.
I said, no, I said she may be, because certainly if you look at her comments over the course of the past couple of years, she has expressed her concerns. She has expressed her concerns.
Okay, so that was Helen Thomas and my guest Scott McClellan at a press briefing. Scott McClellan, was it a tactic when you or anyone else in the White House was getting tough, challenging questions to try to discredit the reporter asking the questions, in Helen Thomas's case, to say, well, sure, you're saying that because you don't believe in the broader war on terrorism? Or like when David Gregory was asking you after Hurricane Katrina if you had confidence, if Bush had confidence in the head of FEMA and the head of Homeland Security, and you kept accusing him of playing the blame game of finger pointing, and he said, no, I want to know, it's a legitimate question, do you have confidence in the head of FEMA and Homeland Security? And you kept saying, no, you're playing the blame game. So was that like a conscious tactic when someone's asking a question that seems challenging or, you know, negative, to try to discredit them or make it seem like they were being unpatriotic? Can you talk
about
that?
Well, I don't know so much about, at least from my standpoint, about unpatriotic, but yes, in terms of sometimes in terms of deflecting the question or maybe discrediting. I mean, certainly in the instance when you played with Helen Thomas, she is now an opinion columnist, and she has very strong opinions, and she's also a very good reporter. But absolutely, I mean, sometimes you're trying to deflect the question and maybe turn it back to where you'll be in the position where you're on the offensive instead of in this defensive crouch. And other times, like with Helen Thomas, you're trying to turn it back to the broader message we were trying to get across at the time, which was that what I said in response to her about fighting them over there instead of fighting them over here and things of that nature.
Let's talk about Iraq. You write a lot about the lead up to a war in Iraq and what came afterwards in your book. One of the things you write is that Bush and then Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld decided to update the Pentagon's war plans for Iraq in November 2001. In effect, you say, Bush had already made the decision to go to war, even if he convinced himself it might still be avoided. You say war was inevitable, given the course of action the president set from the beginning. Bush managed the crisis in a way that almost guaranteed that the use of force would become the only feasible option. Are you saying that this was intentional to make sure that there was no other option, that Bush did things like give an ultimatum at the UN, order a massive buildup of American arms and military forces in the region to make sure that no matter what Congress wanted, no matter what the UN said, there was no choice but to go to war?
Well, he left himself no flexibility whatsoever, and I think his advisors served him poorly in that way. The president should always maintain some flexibility, but it goes to what you just brought up, that the president really had, I would come to learn, made his decision. And it's the way President Bush operates or approaches policy. He tends to be an instinctive player and make the policy decision early on and then say, how do we go about implementing this? And the policy decision he made early on was that we're going to confront Saddam Hussein, and not too long after 9/11, we're going to confront Saddam Hussein. We're going to remove his regime unless he comes fully clean. And I don't think, reflecting back on this, I think it was probably unreasonable to expect that Saddam Hussein was going to be the kind of guy, given his past, that would just come fully clean and say, okay, come into my country and you can go all over it and do whatever you want.
You write that you finally figured out that the decision to go to war was based largely on the desire within the Bush administration to overthrow Saddam Hussein and then spread democracy through the Middle East. The dream of a democratic Middle East, you say, was the most powerful force behind Bush's drive to war. But, you say, Bush and his advisors knew that the American people would most certainly not support a war launched primarily for the ambitious purpose of transforming the Middle East. And then you say that rather than open this Pandora's box about spreading democracy through the Middle East, because that would raise all kinds of questions,
right,
that instead the Bush administration tried to make the WMD threat larger than it was. They tried to make the Iraqi connection to terrorism appear more certain than it was. They quietly ignored or disregarded some of the crucial caveats in the intelligence, minimized evidence that pointed in the opposite direction. They used innuendo and implication to encourage Americans to believe things that were unclear or possibly false about Iraq. A lot of people have said this, but you're saying it from having been within the inner circle. Tell us something that led you to these conclusions that only somebody within the inner circle would know about.
Well, when I became press secretary, I participated in many world leader meetings with the president and saw up close in these small group settings how passionately the president believed in the freedom agenda, believed in transforming the Middle East as a key component of the war on terrorism. And over the course of time, I came to learn that that was really what was driving his decision-making on Iraq and his belief. And it's also something that probably clouds some of his judgment today in terms of being able to recognize some of the larger realities of the problems that we have faced over the course of time being in there. But one of the themes in the book that I talk about is how dangerous it can become when you take this permanent campaign, this political campaign mentality, and transfer that over to the war-making decision process or war-making campaign process. When you engage too much in trying to sell the war and You get caught up in doing what you would do for any political campaign or any other domestic policy issue and start overstating or overpackaging the case, then it becomes very dangerous later on. And we saw that because we weren't as open and forthright as we should have been. And then it turned out that a lot of what we were saying was wrong.
Scott McClellan, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry. I enjoyed it.
Scott McClellan served as White House press secretary under President Bush. Our interview was recorded in June after the publication of his memoir. Our series on presidential history and politics concludes tomorrow. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org.